This week on COVID Race and Democracy.
Somalia is washed with mostly Chinese manufactured inexpensive mobile phones. So a lot of people, including nomads that are in the middle of nowhere, get their news through social media. And that's primarily how people learn about the conflict. That's how people are learning about U.S.'s role.
Anti-American sentiment is widespread in Somalia, and now the plan to build a military base in secessionist Somaliland is fueling unionist resistance.
Well, today it's the African People's Socialist Party, but it's going to be somebody else tomorrow if they get away with this. And so solidarity is essential at this point. It's a message to everyone, you know, don't oppose the state, and we can't tolerate that.
The U.S. Department of Justice has indicted members of the African People's Socialist Party for exercising their First Amendment rights.
We were standing against the seizing of public resources by billionaires. We were standing against the widening wealth gap in this country. This billionaire can't come in here and build a playground where we work.
International Longshore Workers Union activists battled the billionaire owner of the Oakland Athletics baseball team in his failed attempt to grab the Howard Terminal in the Port of Oakland to build a stadium. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Anti-American sentiment is widespread in Somalia, and the presence of U.S. troops in the country is often reported to serve as a recruiting tool for the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Now it's helping to inspire Somali unionists fighting Somaliland secessionists in the city of Lasanad and the surrounding regions of Sul, Sanaag, and Kain. I spoke to Jamal Abdullahi, a Somali-American software engineer and writer who has family in the Sul, Sanaag, and Kain region. Jamal, what is the source of anti-American sentiment in Somalia?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I think the biggest one is one of cultural. The Somalis happen to be overwhelmingly Muslim Sunni majority nation with a conservative inclination. So the glamorous life of Hollywood doesn't resonate with the broader society of Somalia. There's also the issue of the United States' unimpeded support for Israel at the expense of Palestinians. So that offends a lot of Somalis as well. Now, there are more political reasons. For instance, in the 1976-77 war between Ethiopia and Somalia, Somalia asked United States for support after the Soviet Union sided with Ethiopia. But many Somalis felt that the United States turned them down and did not help. More recently, in 2006, the United States, under the leadership of George W. Bush, used Ethiopia Defense Forces as a proxy to crash a number of grassroots groups under the banner of the Islamic Corps Union and crushed that group and dispersed that group and captured Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia. And that humiliated Somalis. The level of humiliation at that time was just astounding when it comes to Somalis. And more recently, in the 2023 Defense Appropriation Act, there is a plan to be able to establish a base in this northern city of Berbera. And that has triggered a brutal war that mostly revolves around in the city of Lasanot, and where thousands are estimated to have been killed on both sides, many civilians in the city, as well as over 200,000 people being displaced. So that's more of the, some of the reasons that make the Somali public super angry with the United States policy in their country.
How did Somalis in Lasanad and the Sul, Sanaag, and Kain region learn about the plan to build the U.S. military base?
So there are two things that work in Somalia, and that is a mobile broadband and a digital currency. You would be hard-pressed to find any banknotes in Somalia. Everyone uses digital currency. And it's mostly done through mobile phones. And Somalia is washed with mostly Chinese manufactured inexpensive mobile phones. So a lot of people, including nomads that are in the middle of nowhere, get their news through social media. And that's primarily how people learn about the conflict. That's how people are learning about U.S.'s role in Somalia. And including my own family member, my own relatives in the region are telling me how they heard about in the conflict was through their cell phones.
Somaliland has regular forces with commanders in the regional government of Somaliland. But President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed has not sent the Somali National Army to help the people of Sul, Sanaag, and Kain, even though they're nationalists. So the forces defending them are irregular forces. How were they formed and armed?
That's a very good question, because just a few months ago, not a single gun would be allowed in the city of Los Anos that did not have the approval of the secessionist. But in such a short period of time, there was this abundance of a fighting force that wanted to resist the idea of a secessionist. And in a very short period of time, the secessionists actually lost quite a bit of territories in and around the city of Los Anos. Right now, they're mostly concentrated in a military base called Gochade, which is several miles outside of the city. The first wave of a military support came from the city of Buholde, and that is a very resistive city to secessionism, in which the secessionists never control over their 30 years of split in Somalia. So that snowballed and invited many, many people to come to the support and the rescue of Los Anos residents, including people that are nomads in the surrounding area who are out of their self-conscious, decided to join this struggle. So then there were various other clan affiliation and others that have sent reinforcements, but the primary arm, you know, a fighting force is local.
And what outcome do you expect?
Well, I certainly hope that this is coming to an end in a fairly conclusion. There are a number of proposals that have been, you know, put out that, but the first and foremost, in which the leadership of Los Anos and more broadly, Sul, Sanaag, and Ain have been requesting the leader of the secessionist, Musa Bihi, to withdraw forces into the city of Og, which is about 90 to 100 miles north of Los Anos, and to allow discussions and conversations and negotiations to occur to bring this into a peaceful conclusion, because there have been enough bloodshed in this short period of time. But that doesn't seem to be likely. Musa Bihi seems to be determined to violently to take control of Los Anos. And his primary reason is that he somehow erroneously concluded that if he left Los Anos, or if he lost control of Sul, Sanaag, and Ain, that somehow the United States will dump him or stop supporting him. That's one of the things that, he's definitely wrong about it. But right now he seems to be gearing up for more violence and more bloodshed.
Well, EU and U.S. officials, they say that they asked Somaliland to withdraw from Sul, Sanaag, and Kain, and that they were disappointed when they did not. Do you think the U.S. and the EU officials were sincere in asking that they withdraw?
I think they were sincere, but they were not forceful in their request enough such that it would force Musa Bihi to a change of directions. I think the statement that they released was very weak, but I think more firmed about it, they could have been more impactful. But I think their position of urging him to withdraw forces is valid one, and it has a broader support within the Somali peninsula.
So you think to get them to really withdraw, the U.S. would have had to say, basically, you no longer have our support if you don't withdraw from the region?
Yes, I think that would definitely make him think twice. If the United States comes out of the gate and says, for instance, that there is no such thing as Somaliland, this is a region of a sovereign that is part of the sovereign nation of Somalia, and we are going to treat it as such. Okay, and if you don't do this within very short period of time, then there will be some consequences. I think if the United States deploys all of its soft power, they could be more effective. But they seem to be in a mode of an appeasement to the secessionists.
Well, I wasn't actually thinking if they said we won't accept Somaliland as an independent state, but what if they said we will not support you if you do not withdraw your troops from Sana'a and the surrounding region?
Yes, I think that would be more impactful position. They said the United States will not support Hargeisa and Mousabih anymore unless they withdraw. I think that would force him to think twice and may have changed his thus far posture of amassing more troops into the outskirts of Las Anat.
Okay, Jamal, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Thank you.
That was Somali-American software engineer and writer Jamal Abdullahi. Sounds of Somalia, traditional Somali music. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm In Garrison. On April 18, the U.S. Department of Justice issued indictments of African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omali Yeshitela, African People's Solidarity Committee Chair Penny Hess, and Uhuru Solidarity Movement Chair Jesse Neville, and three Russian nationals. The unsealed indictment states that a federal grand jury in Tampa, Florida, levied charges of, quote, conspiring to covertly sow discord in U.S. society, spread Russian propaganda, and illegally interfere in U.S. elections, unquote. The Black Alliance for Peace has issued a statement in which they unequivocally condemn and oppose the indictment, saying, quote, while no evidence of conspiracy, propagandizing, or interference has been presented, the African People's Socialist Party and its members have the right, as all U.S. citizens do, to freely criticize U.S. domestic and foreign policy. Unquote. We hear from Ajamu Baraka, founder of the Black Alliance for Peace, Margaret Flowers, editor of PopularResistance.org, and Garland Nixon, host of the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik.
Well, this is a very important and insidious turn by the U.S. state. It's an assault on not only the African People's Socialist Party, but it's really an assault on the Black liberation movement in general, and in fact, the radical left anti-war and anti-imperialist organizations in the United States of America. The message that is being conveyed is quite clear. It is, if you oppose U.S. warmongering policies, if you specifically oppose Ukraine and the policies of the proxy war, and you have any relationships with any organizations or states outside of the U.S., you run the risk of being charged with being an unregistered agent of those states and facing the full weight of the criminal injustice system in the U.S. So it is a very dangerous term that is really similar to what we saw directed toward the movement in the late 1940s, early 1950s, with the indictment of W.B. Du Bois in 1951 as a co-director of the Peace Information Center. He was indicted because he was advocating for peace with the Soviet Union. And this, of course, was at the height of the McCarthy era. And the objective there, as today, is political intimidation, imposing an ideological conformity on the population. In this case, it is support for U.S. policy in Ukraine and to contain the population that's been the most consistent in its anti-war and anti-imperialist positions, really up until the ascendancy of Barack Obama, and that is the Black community and the Black liberation movement forces. So it is something that everyone should be concerned with. And we should have a vigorous opposition to this, because if we allow them to target and isolate the African People's Socialist Party, all of us are vulnerable.
And, you know, Margaret, here's the thing. I was reading about their indictment, and they're alleged that they were sowing discord. Well, discord, a synonym for discord is dissent. I go on the radio here. I go on Pacifica. I go on various YouTube shows. And yes, I'm a dissenter. I oppose the U.S. foreign policy of imperialism. So if discord now is a crime, then dissent is a crime. At any rate, your thoughts on all of this, Margaret Flowers?
Yeah, no, I want to echo what Ajamu said about how important this is. And this is, you know, as he brought up the history of the U.S., but we can look at history of repressive regimes around the world and how they go after those who are on the left, those who are organizing to, you know, support communities that are struggling and to, you know, enable them to be able to, you know, if your basic needs are met, then you have the space to try to organize to change things. And that's as we're in a state that is failing, that's losing power in the world, that's throwing more and more money into the military and less into the social programs that we need. And we face other crises with the healthcare crisis and the climate crisis. What this is basically a message to folks is that, you know, we're going to come after you if you try to oppose what we're doing. And, you know, in desperation, they're going to lash out. So this is really critical because it's, you know, today it's the African People's Socialist Party, but it's going to be somebody else tomorrow if they get away with this. And so solidarity is essential at this point. Everybody should be speaking about this. Everybody should be going to the Uhuru Movement website, the Uhuru Solidarity website, and checking it out and supporting them and really saying that we won't tolerate this because it's going to take away our space to be able to. It's a message to everyone, you know, don't oppose the state, and we can't tolerate that.
And here's something that's, I guess, weird. I want to get your thoughts on it. You know, not a peep from the Congressional Black Caucus, Black leaders, Black Democrats, anywhere. That's not surprising. But listen to this. Yesterday, Glenn Greenwald goes on Tucker Carlson and they both say, hey, I'm against this. I oppose this. I see a video today. There's Glenn Beck, far right reactionary people saying, hey, I oppose this. This is a First Amendment. But again, we hear nothing from the Black misleadership class, Ajamu.
It really is incredible, but also in some ways unsurprising. If this Black misleadership class in Congress has been so fundamentally corrupted that it has no independent voice, no independent perspective, its politics are to the far right. And people have to understand, remember, when we talk about neoliberalism, which is the predominant ideological trend of the Democrat Party, we're talking about a rightist political movement and a rightist ideology. So these folks are in favor of more repressive power by the state. And if they if there's no opposition from other liberal left forces, then they're not going to risk any kind of political capital to say anything, to even raise a question, to say maybe this might be troubling. They're not going to lift a finger. That's just the nature of those politics. So I'm concerned. I'm not that concerned about that element. What I'm more concerned about is the relative silence coming from the so-called left. Is it that people believe that because there's a indictment that there may be the possibility of some truth in the allegations? Is it because maybe people just don't give a damn about radical forces in this country? I mean, what is it that you have this kind of attack on a legitimate organization that's been in place for 50 years without a peep? Well, there's a few groups, UNIC and others, made some comments, but that's really about it. It's really, really troubling and really, really dangerous.
Well, you know, let me add this, Margaret. The idea that the FSB, the Russians, are sitting there and they're saying, you know, if we really wanted to overthrow the government, the St. Petersburg City Council and the mayor's race. Why don't we run somebody that's going to get, oh, let's say 2% of the vote or less? The idea that the FSB is plotting to take over the United States and they're starting on the St. Petersburg City Council is laughable on its face. To me, that's evident. When I look at that and I'm saying you're making such a preposterous foundational claim that this suit should be, I mean, that these charges should be dismissed immediately. Margaret.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. They don't have any evidence to support their claims. They're making things up. They were fishing for things. That's why they conducted the FBI raid to see what they could come up with, to cobble something together, to make some sort of a story. But, you know, we know it's all concocted. And so that you know, that people should be aware of the ridiculousness of this and the fact that it doesn't have any evidence, but they might get away with it because, as Ajamu said, people are not paying attention. They may think that it's legitimate because they gave some sort of indictment. I mean, look at the indictment against Julian Assange. There's nothing there either. But, you know, but the United States, the Biden administration is continuing to pursue that. So this is why, you know, folks have got to pull their heads up above the trees and look at what's going on here and realize that the United States will do anything, make up anything, lie to people in order to push their agenda and try to silence anyone who might rise up and try to organize to, you know, so that people can live with dignity, so people can survive. This is what this organization has been doing for all this time, is organizing in communities to support people and to educate them so they understand what's going on. This is not a crime, but the state sees it as a crime because they know that as things continue to fail, more people will rise up and they want to send a strong message. You do that, we'll come after you. We don't care if you haven't done anything wrong. We'll make something up and come after you anyway. It's pure intimidation.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers, editor of PopularResistance.org, and Ajamu Baraka, founder of the Black Alliance for Peace, speaking with Garland Nixon, host of The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik.
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffers, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The US government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that you're spitting, they just listen and absorbing. I've been dormant, I've awoken. I'm a giant, I'm ready. I'm with the Apple in Oaxaca and we hold the machetes. I rock hard like Palestinian children holding slingshots. I'm with every single kid that's down for hip-hop. For the culture, the life, what it really stands for. This music is resistance, it's the voice of the poor. I'm on the side of the workers, the teachers, the lunch ladies. On the streets with brown mommies, raising our brown babies. I'm with youth organizers, cleaning up the Bronx River. I'm like Jaime Escalante when I stand and deliver. I'm with Evo Morales, man, he running Bolivia. Distribution of the land so we can all live bigger. I'm with Hugo and Fidel, Grandmaster Amelie Mel. I'm with the Panthers up in Queens, justice for Sean Bell. I'm with Camacho Negron, I'm with Ojeda Rios. Freedom for Oscar Roque, it's time to get in the build. I'm with a blue Jamal, I'm with a Sada Shakur. I'm with the compas in the market, he getting a penny more.
That was Rebel Diaz, Which Side Are You On? You're listening to Pacifica's Covered Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. John Fisher, the billionaire owner of the Oakland Athletics baseball team, has been trying to grab the publicly owned Howard Terminal in the Port of Oakland for years. His plan was to build a new athletic stadium and luxury condos with over $800 million in public funding. Recently, it's been announced that Fisher will seek to build a new stadium for the Athletics in Las Vegas instead. ILWU Local 10 past president Trent Willis talked about the fight against the land grab with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
Well, I'd like to first start off by clearing up a misconception. I had a reporter contact me yesterday, and he asked me, were we celebrating as a union? And I didn't really understand what he was talking about at first. So I said, what will we be celebrating? And he mentioned that the A's were moving to Las Vegas. And I said, well, we're not celebrating that, okay? We want to make it clear that our issues were not with the Oakland A's, okay, as a team. And we're not happy to see the Oakland A's move to Las Vegas. We would have rather saw the A's play in a brand new stadium at the current site. Okay, so we want to get rid of that misconception as that some kind of way we as working people and the people opposed to the Howard Terminal Baseball Stadium project were some kind of way enemies of the Oakland A's. We were actually standing against the seizing of public resources by billionaires. We were standing against the widening wealth gap in this country. In too many situations when it comes to these pro baseball teams, with the owners being billionaires, and not just pro baseball teams, but pro teams in general. Most of these sports teams have billionaire owners. They want to come into these cities and they want to hoodwink the city officials into turning over public resources to them for pennies on the dollar, or for sometimes no money at all. And these public resources that they're coming after are very valuable resources to the poor people that live in these cities, in these counties, in these states, these public resources that many people need to survive. Okay, like the land at Howard Terminal. That's a major plot of land that supplies jobs for not directly at the site, but for thousands of people. That terminal being open for business supports thousands of jobs, waterfront jobs. And that's what we were saying. We were saying that this billionaire can't come in here and build a playground where we work. And then when you look into it, when you look deep into it, this was never about the Oakland A's. If you look at the underlying scheme here, the Oakland A's team, the A's baseball team, was injected into this to tear at the hearts of the fans and to get them to put a stamp of approval on what was clearly a land grab and an effort to build high-priced condominiums on that property. If you look at the situation realistically, you'll realize that the owners of the Oakland A's, the Fisher family, had already purchased a partial plot of land at the Oakland Coliseum site. So there was no need to go to Las Vegas and buy another plot of land just like it and build a stadium there. They could have built the stadium at the current Coliseum site, which proves that they were after the land. And I mean at both sites, the Coliseum site and the Howard Terminal site, to build condos. It had nothing to do with the A's baseball team. Last year, Dave Cavall was visiting Las Vegas and looking at plots of land to build a stadium for the A's to move to Las Vegas. Everyone knows they were moving to Las Vegas anyway, and this scheme was put together to seize public land and to take it from the public, privatize it, give it to a billionaire, pennies on the dollar.
And this was supported by Democratic Party politicians. Rob Bonta, who was an assemblyman, now he's the Attorney General of California. They actually introduced a bill, Nancy Skinner, in the California state legislature to override protection for port land and to allow for tax money, hundreds of millions of tax money, to be used for this project. What do you think about the fact that the Democrats, which unions support, are saying that we should give money to billionaires for their development projects?
I think that that's terrible. And I don't think it's anything new. You know, when you're talking about the differences between the Republicans and the Democrats, there's not much there. You know, the system is what we need to be talking about. The system that makes it where Republicans and Democrats exist at all. The system is geared and designed for that to happen. The system is designed to whoever we put in office, doesn't matter. They can be bribed. They can be paid off. The people don't have enough resources to influence the situation. The billionaires have the resources to influence politicians and to do things behind the scenes and pay people off that the regular everyday Joe Schmo like me and you, the working man, we don't have that kind of reach. We don't have that kind of money. You know, we don't have that kind of power. Our strength lies in our numbers. So as we confront all of these different challenges that working people have, one of them is identity politics. It's designed to divide us, where we don't become that solid, cohesive group that can challenge these billionaires and can get these elected officials' attention. Doesn't matter if they're a Republican or a Democrat. Okay. What matters is who has access to that person. Okay. So if you have access to an elected politician and you have $1 million to give them, and then your opponent doesn't have any money, who do you think the politician is going to listen to? This capitalist system is designed to where that is possible, to buy off politicians. Okay. And then we get stuck in this identity politics trap of the Republicans and the Democrats, where we're arguing over who's going to represent us the best, when neither one of them are representing us at all.
Now, one of the other issues is the union, trade union movement itself, business unionism. In the struggle at Howard Terminal, you were not only facing Democratic politicians, but the Alameda Labor Council and the building trades, and they gave $700,000 to the mayor of Oakland. They were supporting the port development or the stadium development, saying it would provide jobs. And they were using union money for that purpose. Is that an issue, and how can that be confronted?
It's a serious issue, you know, because what we're finding is that, I'm not going to mention any labor organizations by name, but you're witnessing the watering down of these organizations that used to be strong pillars for working people are now backwater channels for manipulators and politicians to get to working people in ways that they couldn't get to working people before. For example, you mentioned the building trades. Well, the building trades' main talking points were that this would create jobs, good union jobs. This would create an opportunity for building trade unions to get the jobs of building the stadium. But really what you had was you had politicians who had infiltrated these unions through many different avenues and influencing these union leaders to cooperate in a way where they're actually cooperating with the enemy, which the enemy to working people is people like John Fisher, okay, to try to come to town and take the resources that the working people are using to survive. But while they're saying all of these sound good talking points, was what I like to call them, they're actually working for the enemy.
That was Pacifica's Steve Seltzer interviewing ILWU Local 10 past president Trent Willis about billionaire baseball team owner John Fisher's failed land grab in the city of Oakland.
United we're as strong as a mountain. United we're as deep as the sea. Stand together, shoulder to shoulder, sisters and brothers, united and free. It seemed to be the right time, the right place, a love of country to the fore. Smiles on eager faces, a nation's heart beating here once more. Those in power knew just what they wanted. Divide and rule was their cry. When the votes were cast and counted, the hopes of thousands by lies. United we're as strong as a mountain. United we're as deep as the sea. Stand together, shoulder to shoulder, sisters and brothers, united. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm In Garrison. The police department of Antioch, a small California town, faces a scandal over racist text exchanged by its police officers. The several officers first implicated grew until 8 officers were forced to take paid leave. Within days, the number grew to 16, then 22. Soon, nearly half the Antioch Police Department's officers were under investigation by the FBI. 16 of the officers involved were in leadership roles. The text included those of a police officer openly encouraging someone to shoot the current black mayor. However, the scandal was a disaster in the making for many years. In 2009, Antioch police arrested and brutally beat Frank Sterling, a producer and host for Pacifica's KPFA radio, for defending his constitutional rights. The police knew him to advocate for the homeless and investigate police brutality. In 2021, the police attacked and detained him again while he was reporting on a legal demonstration against racist police brutality in a public park. Mehmet Bayram reports on the scandal and its precedents, which led to the current FBI investigation.
Racism in the Antioch Police Department. It was only last year, in February of 2022, a report in the Black Agenda report by Anne Garrison exposed an attack against a journalist by the Antioch police in California. We learned from this report that Frank Sterling, a reporter for KPFA radio station in Berkeley, California, also a Native American, was beaten systematically, targeted by the Antioch police, the small town he lived in. Frank was an advocate for homeless people and exposed police brutality. He tried to show the systemic character of the police attacks, especially in Antioch. This Berkeley local KPFA station journalist was brutally attacked by cops who wanted to enter his home without a search warrant, and Frank defended his constitutional right. The evidence of racist and corrupt police organizing under the Antioch Police Department was there for all to see. However, the local press, which had all the information on the illegal police conduct, refused to challenge this criminal activity. The Antioch Police Department was not only targeting journalists like Frank Sterling for years, but officers were exchanging texts calling people monkeys and orangutans and encouraging and congratulating other cops for hurting people during interactions with the public. How could a police department enjoy the privilege of not being accountable for so long when nearly half, that is at least 45 cops in its ranks, were known to be involved in racist, homophobic texts and calling for violence? At least 16 of these police officers were acting in leading roles in Antioch. Now the FBI is involved and is investigating whether so many officers being involved constitutes what happened as gang activity. 22 officers are on paid leave, and already more than 40 cases against suspects have been dropped due to police falsifying evidence. Many more cases could be dropped because the cops tainted all information in it. In one case, the suspect was unconscious and could not consent to a blood test, but another officer texted, "No, we'll just say he refused to comply and take the blood," and added, "They could always say the suspect evaded police and use that to obtain the blood." What was happening was evident even in 2009 when Frank Sterling was beaten by the officers illegally trying to enter his home. Lying unconscious on the ground and coming to, he opened his eyes to see a police officer looking down at him and saying, "This is what you get for effing with the police." The assault was a vengeance attack by the cops. They were punishing a reporter for exposing their crimes. That police officer threatening Sterling was Rick Hoffman. Instead of an investigation, Officer Rick Hoffman became the president of the Antioch Police Officers Association. Hoffman and his partner in crime, Officer Chris Kent, enjoyed drawing their salaries for attacking people, and they received many awards protected by the corrupt police organizations. Sterling finally won the case against the police in 2014 after 6 years of being charged with bogus claims. The recent scandal naturally extended also to the neighboring police department, showing how widespread the problem is. Although the mayor didn't give details, a resigned officer may have been involved in an illegal drug abuse, local Channel News 2 reports. The police texts show that the mayor was also a target, with one officer offering a prime rib dinner to anyone who would shoot the mayor. In February of 2022, before his court hearing, I asked Frank to comment on the events that led to his charges.
Yeah, this is Frank Sterling, and I'm out here in Pittsburgh at the Superior Court in Pittsburgh. They're trying to charge me allegedly with resisting arrest during a protest against the Antioch police chief. Well, it was a going away party for the chief, Tammany Brooks, who was leaving Antioch and taking a new job in Boise, Idaho. And he was being celebrated by a group called Antioch Backs the Blue and a couple other community organizations. And we came as a small group to say that he is not to be celebrated due to the crimes he committed, we feel, against our community.
This was on September 21st, last year, 2021.
Yeah, September, it was like, I think it was the 18th.
18th, okay. Yeah. And this happened at an Antioch public park.
Yeah, at a park. Yeah, basically, the people, the back, the blue, and the other people that were there to celebrate the chief, not everybody, but, you know, a couple instigators, wanted to rip our signs out of our hands and urged others to join in on, like, blocking us. Basically, they were doing photo ops with the chief, and everybody was kind of doing the handshake and taking their picture with the chief. They gave him a plaque and how much they loved him. And we were in the background trying to hold up our protest signs and get him in the photo op, so they'd have to be cropped out or they'd be in there. And people started trying to take our signs and block us physically with their bodies. The band struck up some music and everybody tried to dance in our way. And basically kind of devolved from there as people tried to take our signs and our bullhorn from us. People other than me, of course, I wasn't in any altercation, but other members of my group who were being attacked by this woman, Denise Cantrell, who was physically trying to rip our protest signs out and our bullhorn.
Was she a police officer?
No, she was one of the organizers of the event.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just devolved from there into kind of like a melee where the police kind of pushed them aside and then arrested us.
We don't know how deep the investigation will go and whether all the racist corrupt cops will be cleaned from the Antioch and Pittsburgh police departments. Reporting for COVID, Race and Democracy, this is Mehmet Bayram.
And in a matter of minutes, on bail was out walking. But you, who philosophize disgrace and criticize fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears.
The Japanese government plans to release 1.3 million tons of radioactive water into the Pacific from the Fukushima nuclear plant in coming months. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida of the Liberal Democratic Party, with support of the Biden administration, has told the people of Japan and the world that this is very safe. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer interviewed Caitlin Strunnell from the Citizens Nuclear Treatment Center in Tokyo and Sakura Force with the Pacific Asian Nuclear Free Peace Alliance.
So the issue with the water in Fukushima Daiichi, which the government is, right now there's elections in Japan, and so probably they might not decide on actually releasing the water until after the elections are over. But in any case, it's pretty imminent that, you know, they're going to actually start releasing this water, this radioactive wastewater into the Pacific. So there's a lot of issues. Obviously, there's been huge protests in Japan right from the beginning. Like, it was announced almost exactly 2 years ago by the then Prime Minister Suga that the government had authorized this release. But even before that, TEPCO and there'd been various hearings in Fukushima local areas. There was just so much opposition. The hearings, there was hardly anyone who thought it was a good idea. The fisher folk, of course, are deeply concerned that, you know, after 12 years where they haven't been able to actually catch fish to sell, they've all been kind of caught and then tested for radiation. They've finally thought that they could get back to their livelihood. And now this happens. And of course, it's going to be very difficult for them to sell fish. So basically, the fisher people are completely opposed. And obviously, various other groups in Fukushima and other areas of Japan are also opposed. And of course, the international opposition we've seen just grow and grow. Yeah, obviously the oceans are not just Japan's, and Japan making this unilateral decision to release this water has made a lot of people very angry. The Pacific Island Forum has commissioned a report, which was five independent experts who made an analysis of the situation. They were able to talk to TEPCO and get data. And their conclusion was that really, there's some very serious scientific problems. For one, there's nobody actually really knows what's in the tanks. And, you know, there's kind of a scientific level that you're supposed to do sampling. You're supposed to figure out what exactly is in there. And they haven't really even met these scientific standards. So, and they refuse to let anyone independently test the tanks. So we don't really know what's in them. And they've said that they're going to run the 70% of the water that's there now, which is above the standards for that they've said is safe to release. So they have to run it through another filtration system called ELPS. And it didn't work the first time. There's no guarantee that it's going to work the second time. And they haven't really got a proper plan. They just say, well, we're going to keep running it through this filtration system till it gets to the right standard. But at the moment, it's planned on taking 30 to 40 years. That's 30 to 40 years that the fishermen can't sell their fish. And the other point that the Pacific Island scientists mentioned was that they haven't really considered alternatives. There's been several alternatives put forward and they've kind of been dismissed. It's just, there's no real explanation why this is the best solution. So, yeah, there's a lot of problems and it really is going to affect the global commons of the ocean. So, you know, I think it really is an international issue.
Well, when it was sold to Japan by Ronald Reagan, who at that time was working for General Electric, he called it Atoms for Peace. You know, it's 12 years after Fukushima and most people are unaware that they still have not removed the radioactive rods. Melted radioactive rods in the nuclear reactors. They still have to cool them with water, which then becomes contaminated. They have tritium in that water. And they also have nuclear waste from Fukushima, which is still spread out, thousands and thousands of bags of radioactive waste spread out over Fukushima. And the government has wanted other prefectures to take those bags, kind of a collective responsibility, distributing the waste throughout Japan. So this release of the water, it's opposed by people, and there have been actions in Korea and other countries. Even in the United States, there's opposition to it. And Sukuru, maybe you can talk about a rally that was held in New York and growing opposition in the United States to the release of this radioactive.
So recently, Holtec International, who is a manufacturer of nuclear, you know, power generation related equipment and also operator and literally making a killing of the decommissioning business. So Holtec International announced its plan to release, you know, radioactive wastewater from Indian Point Energy Center, which is a decommissioned nuclear power plant, into the Hudson River, of all places. So that was actually the issue, along with the Fukushima issue, that was being talked about at this rally. So, you know, we are trying to drum up support, raise awareness and drum up support of New Yorkers because, you know, that's a really issue that affects them directly. But this really actually, captures their attention to the Fukushima issue as well. So that's what took place in New York. But I mean, the thing is, and I was lucky to be able to speak a little bit at this rally too. But so the Fukushima wastewater release, really, you know, if it's allowed to happen, it sets a dangerous precedent, because now, you know, they are being, you know, they will be able to say, oh, they're doing it in Fukushima, we can do it too. And, you know, it's not as if it's not happening in the United States. It's already happening. The United States government, you know, currently is in support of, you know, this practice of releasing wastewater into, you know, the ocean and the rivers and whatnot. You know, it's happening in San Onofre, you know, about 70 miles from LA. You know, it's a decommissioned plant, and they are releasing it into the Pacific Ocean, you know, on the area where there are a lot of surfers are, you know, actively surfing. And so they are actually, the nuclear industry is very successful in creating this narrative that wastewater release from either active or decommissioned nuclear power plants is a routine practice and a commonplace. And they're being very, very successful at that. So, you know, we really should not let this, you know, water release from Fukushima happen, and also into the Hudson River.
And there are over 100 nuclear plants in the United States. Many of them, their lifetime, they want to extend the plants. They want to extend the lifetime of plants in Japan. Japan is known as the Ring of Fire. Fukushima is still a disaster, even though they haven't said it's a disaster. In fact, the former Prime Minister Abe said they've overcome the situation. It's been decontaminated. He would lie to the Olympic Commission. He lied to people. It's still going on. And the Biden administration, the Democrats and Republicans, want to build small nuclear plants, supposedly better small nuclear plants, but they have no place for the waste right now in the over 100 nuclear plants. This whole issue of where to put the waste is still a major issue, both in the United States and Japan. I mean, Caitlin, I mean, the waste from the Fukushima meltdown, it's still there, and there's a struggle in Japan over where it should go.
Yes, and I think on the news this week was they now have even more photos that they've managed to get of the inside of the plant. And yeah, I mean, it's a complete disaster. It's really quite dangerous. The concrete has all eroded. And they say, you know, when in the case of Chernobyl, for example, they put that sarcophagus over it, and it's just as it is. Whereas TEPCO insists that they're going to remove the melted down fuel. And whether they can actually do that, I mean, they've only just got photo after 12 years. They've, you know, they've had a few photos and stuff and information beforehand. But the first bunch of robots they sent in, even the robots died. I mean, you know, it's very unrealistic to imagine that they can even remove that fuel anytime soon. And even if they did, you're absolutely right. What are they going to do with it? And yeah, there's just so many questions. And the thing is that those questions impact what happens now. So because they have this insistence that they're going to fix it up and everything's going to be fine, that means that, you know, that they have to rush and get rid of the water. And it's basically the whole long-term plan, the whole, they call it a roadmap of how they plan to decommission is really, the whole thing really needs to be looked at. And yeah, this idea about, you were mentioning before, Steve, about distributing the radioactivity throughout Japan. I think this really ties in with what Skuru was saying about making it okay. Yeah, it's okay to have radioactive waste everywhere. It's all right. See, nobody's dying. It's all fine. And because it is so hard to prove the connection between radiation and cancer and other diseases, that's one of the reasons they get away with it. But yeah, this whole sort of normalization of radioactive waste in the community is really very scary.
That was Caitlin Strunnell from the Tokyo Citizens Nuclear Treatment Center and Takura Force with Pacific Asian Nuclear Free Peace Alliance. And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the CRD Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.